Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bodang dhammang sanghang namassami. Tonight, I thought to start with some words by our teacher, Lompo Cha. Some of you might remember in August I had a sequence of talks from a book where the teachings were put in a very concise form and a very understandable form. And also what I want to read out to you tonight. I hope it's very understandable. It's from a book called Being Dharma, and it's been translated by someone who was a disciple of Lompo Cha, who actually was a monk and understands Thai very well, and he's done I find, quite good translations of Ajahn Chah's teachings. So I start with that and then use that as a kind of impetus to reflect a little bit further. So the little talk is called Beyond Cause and Effect. Once in the past, I was living with a small group of monks. We stayed in the forest where we had a small sala, a meditation hall, and an altar without much light. One monk was reading a book there, and when his candle burned down, he left the book and went away. Another monk came along and stepped on the book in the dark. He picked it up and thought, that monk doesn't have much mindfulness. Why didn't he know to put the book away? He found the first monk and asked him, "Why didn't you put the book away? I came and stepped on it." The first monk replied, "You didn't have self-control. You weren't careful, so you stepped on the Dharma book." And the other responded, "Why didn't you take care of the book and put it away?" They went back and forth, one blaming the other for not taking care of the book properly, the other blaming him for not being careful and stepping on the book. It's like this if you're only looking for logical answers. There will be no end. In the matter of real Dharma, you have to discard cause and effect. Dhamma is higher than this. The Dhamma the Buddha was enlightened to can quell the mental afflictions and remove suffering. It is above cause and beyond effect. There is no suffering and no happiness. The Dhamma the Buddha taught can pacify our lives, purge causes and results. If you just rely on the logic of cause and effect, there will be endless dispute. Like the two monks arguing over stepping on the book, they could go on forever, logically discussing their reasons. There is no peace this way. We, who study, should learn about cause and effect. Happiness comes from such and such a cause. Suffering comes from such and such causes. We come to know that there is always cause and result in actions. But the Dhamma realized by the Buddha is pacification, that which is above cause and result, beyond happiness and suffering, beyond birth and beyond death. But now you have even more doubts when you hear about this. This is something really important. This is the Dhamma that brings peace. Our desire, our wish to know things quickly, is not Dhamma. It is only our desire. If we act according to desire, there's never any end. You probably know the story of Ananda, the Buddha's attendant. His faith was as strong as anyone's. There was to be the Sanghayana, the Sangha Council, after the passing away of the Buddha, and only arahants would be allowed to attend. Ananda was determined to attain the stage of arahant and began strenuous practice so he could join them. But his mind would not do what he wanted it to do. He was in this coarse state, and over again he was only meeting with frustration. Ah, tomorrow is the Sanghayana. All my Dharma friends, the Arahants, will be attending, but I'm still an ordinary person. What should I do? He decided to meditate from dusk to daybreak. He went at it, but he was only getting fatigued. Coming to the end of his tether, he decided to take a brief rest. At dawn, he set down a pillow and made ready to rest. Having made the determination to rest, his mind had already started letting go, putting down his busyness. Then, lying down, even before his head hit the pillow, his mind let go completely and he saw the Dhamma. He was enlightened to the Arahant stage. Seeking to let go, we can never do it. We could try for years and it wouldn't happen. But in that moment, when Ananda had decided to stop, to take a rest, and put down his burden of wanting attainment, just resting with mindfulness established, the mind let go, and he was able to see and awaken. He didn't have to do anything special. Before, he wanted something to happen, and it didn't work. There was no occasion to take a rest, no occasion to awaken to the Dhamma. Understand that becoming enlightened to the Dhamma is a matter of letting go. Letting go with wisdom, with knowing. It doesn't come about through wanting and struggling, but from letting go in full mindfulness. When there is this taking rest, nothing is bothering the mind. There's no desire to disturb it. Then, instantly, the mind can awaken, as in Ananda's case. Ananda was practically unaware of himself. He knew only that he wasn't getting what he wanted. Desire for enlightenment was thwarting all his efforts, so he decided to take a break. Enlightenment is not something easy to talk about and make people understand. It's difficult to practice if people have the wrong idea. For example, the Buddha said, "This place is not a place for people to dwell. There are the floor and the roof. If there's no roof and no floor, then there's nothing there, right? There's nothing to talk about. The space in between is not the place where people can live. There's no becoming there. Becoming is the upper story or the lower story. If people are going to live somewhere, they must live upstairs or downstairs. No becoming? People aren't interested. People are not interested in letting go. With letting go, is there anything being born? When you go upstairs, that is becoming. You may feel it's nice up there in the higher place. Coming down is not so pleasing to you. You feel it's nice, but it's not the root of suffering. You don't want to put down this pleasure and pain and experience normalcy because you prefer the place where there is becoming. The place without becoming is not of interest to you. Even just to try to conceive of it is very hard. What the Buddha was referring to when he spoke of the place without becoming and birth was just the state of non-attachment. Attachment is the cause for suffering to arise. We can't let go of this grasping attachment, and still we want peace. But it is not peaceful. We live with becoming. Not becoming is something we can't conceive of. That is the habit of people, the mental affliction of humans. Nibbana is said by the Buddha to be beyond becoming and birth. People don't understand this. They only understand matters of becoming and birth. If there is no becoming, there is no place to live. If there is no place to live, what will I do? How will I exist? Ordinary people think it's better to stay here. They want to be born again, but they don't want to die. Is there such a thing? If you want something that cannot be, you will have a big problem. People think like this because they don't understand dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of life. I want to be born, but I don't want death. It boils down to no more than this. The Buddha said that death comes from birth. If you do not want to die, don't be born. People think, well, I don't want to die. I want to be born again, but I don't want to die. You might conclude they're stubborn. Speaking with people who are under the sway of desire and attachment is difficult. Getting to the point of letting go will really be hard. Defilement and craving are like that. The Buddha taught about the state where things don't really exist. If there's no place to set a pillar, how can we talk about building something? That is like no becoming and birth, no place to be born. But when we talk about this, people cannot listen and understand. When talking about self, it is emphatically pointed out that there is no such thing. Self is simply a convention. On the absolute level, the level of liberation, it does not exist. They are just elemental nature arising only for the reason that causes and conditions are manifesting. We suppose that this is a self arising and we grasp at it. When there's this supposition, we grasp at me and then there is mine arising together with it. But we don't even know how this is taking place. So people say things like, I want to be born, but I don't want to die. Speaking of entering the stream of Nibbana, if there's genuine knowing within you, there's no one desiring anything. And further, Nibbana is not a matter of wanting. It isn't something you can desire. This characteristic is not easy to understand. This Dhamma is something you can explain or give to people. Our parents might want to give it to us, but even they don't know what it is, and they have no means to do this. This is something to be known within yourself. You can tell others about it, but there's this problem. Will they really know what you're talking about? If they don't have the realization in their own minds, they won't get it. Thus the Buddha said, the Tathagata merely points the way. Just as I'm doing these days, I'm one who explains, not the one who does it for you. Having been told, you need to practice and realize. Then the marvelous will arise and be known in your mind. There's a story in the scriptures of people asking the Buddha about Nibbana. When he refused to elaborate on it, they began to say it was because he didn't know. How could the Buddha not know? The point is that such a thing is to be realized by each individual. When I speak like this, if you just hear it and believe me, that is not so good. It's not yet genuine. Those who believe others are said by the Buddha to be foolish. He said to listen to things and then contemplate to experience the truth of them. You should be able to listen without merely denying. Receive the words, not merely believing, but investigating their meaning. It isn't a matter of believing or not believing. Put those aside for the time being and contemplate to the best of your ability. There are the two extremes. We lean towards either side, but we don't like to stay in the middle. The middle is the lonely way. When there is attraction, we go that way. When there's aversion, we go that way. Putting them down is lonely. We refuse to go there. The Buddha taught that neither extreme is the way of one who is tranquil. We need to be free of pleasure and pain, for neither is the way of peace. Once free of these things, we can be peaceful. Thinking, I'm so happy, is not it. That is just happiness for suffering in the future. These are the things we have to be wary of. Walking the path, we see the two extremes and keep going. We keep to the middle without desiring them, because we want peace, not pleasure or pain. This is the correct path. The practice of Dhamma is leading to the point of letting go. But we must have knowledge of things according to the truth in order to let go. When real knowledge arises, there will be endurance in the practice of Dhamma. There will be enthusiastic, consistent effort. This is called practicing. Once you've gotten to the end, you don't need to use the Dhamma. Like a saw that you sharpen to cut wood. Once the wood is cut, you put down the saw. You don't need to use it then. The saw is the Dhamma. Dhamma is the tool to help you attain path and fruition. Once we have accomplished this, we put it down. Once the job is done, why would you keep holding the saw? The wood is the wood. The saw is the saw. This is about stopping. having reached the essential point, the end of all the taints of craving and ignorance. The wood is cut. You don't have to cut anymore. You can put down the soul. One who will practice must rely on the Dhamma. That's someone who is not yet finished. But if the job is done, you don't have to do any more. You can naturally let go at that point. With no more attachment, giving meaning to things, there's no need for any more doing. It is the state of peace. When we hear about it, we are full of doubts. What can it be? It seems so far away, but it's actually very close. It is something you can discover in your own mind. Things arise and you come to realize they are not certain. This is not real. That is not real. Where is the real? Right there. Trying to surmise, this is like that, is not right. Let go of things, put down the judging and guessing. We go back and forth, passing it by again and again, and we are always in a state of suffering. End your doubts here. End your doubts and stop. Make an end of it right here. It's a little bit dangerous to read a text like this, because what else can you add to this? Can you? Because it's obviously speaking about a very profound level of Dhamma, where things come to an end, and in a very direct way, where things come to an end. But of course, our teacher Nompo Sha didn't just talk about the end stages, and the ultimate stages. The ultimate realization of Dhamma, but also, of course, it could be go into great details about the intricacies of the actual practice and the training, as it were, especially in the monastery. In his monastery, he was running, as they very often say, a pretty tight ship in his monastery. It was very not only the convention of the Patimokkha rules, the rules the Buddha laid down had to be observed, but there were lots of other observances the monks had to attend to, and what is in Thailand is called the conventions of the monastery, the Khorwat. And Ajahn Chah was very keen that the monks paid attention to that. And of course, with everything, whatever it is you had to do, whether it was, you know, sawing wood or carrying water or giving a talk, listening to a talk, going out to a ceremony or so, he was always encouraging that it had to be done with as much awareness and mindfulness as possible. That was really the very, very crucial point of the emphasis of his teaching. He's always speaking about sati or satipanya, mindfulness or mindfulness and wisdom, sati sampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension, and combining a few aspects of the teaching together to continuously remind his disciples to not forget. And as you might have heard, the word sati, what we have in English or also in German, the translation, not terribly precise, very difficult to translate, but the origin of this word is actually sarati, which means to remember. It refers to the faculty, the memory faculty we have. And in a way, it's actually quite right, isn't it? Because when we try to attend our inner processes, we really want to be present and with it, and not get taken away on a ride by any kind of feeling, emotion, or mental state, then we need to remember this faculty, to apply it and use it in the moment. And of course, this remembering that we possess this faculty, ideally, it could or should take place continuously. Someone once described this, the effort in this area, to, you know, you might remember these old films from the 1920s or so, where they or even earlier where they had these very old cars that needed to be cranked up with a thing in the front. You know, you had to kind of put a piece of iron in the front and turn a few times and then the engine would start. It's the very old days. And first the motor, the engine would stutter a little bit and just make a few sounds, boop, 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 boop. And then eventually, you know, you give it a little bit more and you don't take too long a break. If you take a half an hour break, of course, then you have to start all over again, but you keep at it. And eventually the engine will then pick up and it starts running, starts buzzing. And it's a bit of a coarse image, admittedly, but it's very similar to the cultivation of sati, of mindfulness, that if we don't do it in the kind of persistent way, and reminding ourselves and that to apply this faculty, and then of course then we won't have much benefit from it. So the sati aspect, it appears in so many structural parts of the teachings. It's one factor of the enlightenment factors. It's a central part of the so-called spiritual faculties and so forth. And you have it over and over again, it's mentioned. And of course, then there's the whole essential teachings in the Satipatthana Sutta, a whole detailed instruction how to actually apply it to the various aspects of our experience, to the body, to the feelings, to the mental states, and also how to contemplate with mindfulness. That is also an important thing, that we learn how to contemplate our experience without just getting into normal, everyday, conventional thinking. Just, you know, the normal way of thinking how we experience ourselves day in and day out. And for that to happen, of course, there needs to be established a sense of calm in the mind. The mind needs to be settled and rested so that actually that form of contemplation can happen. And so that's a little bit different theme than this example, which here is mentioned in the reading, when Ananda was, you know, trying to qualify for the first Buddhist council, and he was obviously, he made a lot of effort, and then he got so tired and frustrated, he thought, well, I'll take a break. And then it's a wonderful story, isn't it? He takes a break, and as soon as he does it and gives up all this energetic striving, then even before he hits the pillow, it says actually, literally in the story, his heart awakens. And of course, one could easily mistake that, you know, and apply it to one's own practice and come to the conclusion that taking breaks is what it's all about. You know, if I just take a break at the right moment, and then, you know, I'll be through. But of course, we don't really know exactly how much effort the Venerable Ananda had done before. You know, the conditions gone before, the causes and conditions leading up to that point, when he then decided, you know, the night before the council, okay, today I give it really more than everything I have. I give it not just 100%, 120%. And of course, that was too much. If you give it 120%, then you get quite quickly very tired, because we can't do that. Huh? We are human beings. We are not super. We're not superwoman or superman. We are just normal, ordinary, sentient beings. And just giving 100% actually is quite a lot. Sometimes even 100%, giving 100% can be very tiring, and can be very exhausting. But of course, as it's also mentioned in this little discourse, it's all a matter of balance, isn't it? If we come too much from an attitude of the striving, you know, the intention behind our practice is coming from a very strong place of striving and wanting to get, wanting to become, then this is of course a word which is mentioned a lot in this little episode here, the becoming aspect. If we're coming from becoming, we are already lost. Huh? There's no end to this if The intention behind our effort is coming from a place of becoming. We want something else than we have. Even actually, if it's wanting to become enlightened. If, you know, if we have the motivation, the intention in our mind when we sit down or we do any kind of practice, I want to become enlightened because I don't like the state I have or what I experience now. I find it so unpleasant to be with myself, day in, day out, or right now. I want something else. And wouldn't it be nice to be completely at peace and awakened? And of course, normally we don't talk like that. It sounds almost a little bit naive to speak like that. But somehow, subconsciously, we tend to operate very often like that. We tend to very often operate from a place of becoming, of wanting something else than rather the immediacy of that what we experience in this very moment. And that's why one of the hints was, which were also made in this little reading, was that the awakened mind or the awakened heart is much closer than we think. If we always project ourselves forward in time, we always think that enlightenment, awakening, or the peace of mind and so forth is out there or is in front of us, and I need to really make desperate effort to get there, then it seems to, at least that has been my experience, it seems to move away the goal, which of course admittedly we can't also pretend that we don't want to have peace and want to be fully awakened, do we? That would be fooling ourselves. We have that intention, of course, otherwise why would you practice? But then it seems like in the actual application, we need to forget about that. We need to put this down and just apply ourselves to the moment as it arises and resist the temptation to go for some other state than that one which is there happening now in the immediacy of the moment. And admittedly, yes, this even hearing me speak like that, it sounds almost too simple to be true. But those of you who have practiced for a little while know it's not quite so easy, is it? It's quite a tricky point, actually, because our habit tendencies tend to work against this, work against, even if we say to ourselves, okay, I'm really, my intention now is attending to the moment, I don't want anything else, I want to really be aware as much as I can to this very present moment, we still find that our mind is straying away in this or that direction, and emotions and feelings take over and so forth. Or we just get involved in some inner dialogue about what happened yesterday, or telling ourselves stories about ourselves or other people, fantasizing about the future, and etc., etc., etc. So a good combination in that respect of allowing the mind to settle, peacefully settle, and there are specific practices we can do that we can pave the way, one could say, that the mind can settle. We can practice in the realm of calm meditation, tranquility meditation. And there's a whole array of suggestions we have. No need to go into details about that tonight, of how we can learn to focus, to actually stay, in a very, initially very coarse objects even. Very often it's a very good idea to start with our physical experiences, to attend to the body, just to be with the body. Can be sometimes quite a challenge in itself. Even though the body is so obvious and so coarse, we can feel it, it's tangible, it doesn't run away, it's not so flicking around like our thoughts, our feelings and so forth, it's right here. And even to be with that, with the body and with the breath and so forth, it seems to be the case that for most people that needs some training, the training to attend to be just simply with the physical sensations, with the breathing and so forth. And so, from this teaching here, which was pointed to quite a level of realization, the stage of realization, then of course I'm winding it a little bit back now to that stage of practice where we are cultivating, you know, we are developing the path, and not forgetting that this, of course, this ultimate reality, this peace of mind, or this the realization of that state which is beyond good and bad, which is beyond cause and effect, which is beyond this or that, where all the seeming contradictions, all the dualisms finally get resolved. But if we attend too much to that, it can be very inspiring to talk about the ultimate levels of practice, certainly. I'm certainly find this inspiring, and I take a good dose now and then as a kind of injection to not forget about this, and also to still notice, is it really where I want to go still? Is this still? Or maybe has a part in myself maybe gone to a place of resigning, you know, kind of slight feeling of maybe disappointment or even frustration? Is it still, is that that fire of wanting to realize the truth, is that still there? And that's very useful, isn't it, to bring it up from time to time, that this aspiration is still alive and still, yeah, that's still what at the deepest level of heart where I want to go. But then, as I said before, but then when it comes to the cultivation, application of ourselves in the actual practices, we need to put this behind and really then attend to the immediacy of our experience. And not only that, to the immediacy of the moment-to-moment experience in the body and in the mind, but also the integration into the rest of our lives and the things we do when we are not practicing formally, when we're not sitting on a cushion or walking on a walking path. And speaking about Ajahn Chah, he was very good in also reminding his disciples of that. That yes, it's all good and fine to develop the path in the quietude of one's own room, or kuti as it's called in Thailand, in one's own little hut. But if you think that's the only place where it's happening, and you even attach to your peace and quiet because nobody else interferes with you, nobody else breathes down your neck or drives you up the wall or irritates or annoys you in some other way, then probably that's not quite it. And of course, the real litmus test of practice is when we come into the social area, in the social arena, and realize how we are with other beings, other human beings, how reactive we still are, how quickly our tendency to react with attraction and aversion are triggered. And this is, of course, only then, one could say, an invitation to look a little bit more closely and to apply oneself in a way so that these hindrances, these obstacles, can be overcome, they can be put down. And sometimes this can actually happen in a daily situation, even in an encounter with another human being, with another person, when our awareness is at least strained to some level, we can sometimes notice that somebody says something to us, something provocative or challenging, and we stop right there. We feel the impact. This is not very pleasant, not a very pleasant experience. But then in hindsight, we could say, well, you know, a little while ago, I would have just kind of gone with it and reacted and get drawn into a negative mind state and just blindly reacted out of habit, because what came to my doorstep wasn't very pleasant, was challenging. And then, of course, it's something very, as a practitioner, it's something very reassuring if we can, you know, make such an experience. That actually the habit patterns, that which has had us in its grip, has controlled us and dominated us and even manipulated us into, you know, staying within those tight constraints of the habit patterns, that that actually can be opened up and broken up, that we don't have to be a victim of our mental reactivity, mental emotional reactivity, till the day we die, that there is actually a way out of it. And sometimes these little occurrences, little situations, even in daily life, can be a signpost for us, or a sign, a simple sign to say, yes, yeah, that is, you're on track, you know. You are slowly and gradually grinding away at the habitual tendencies of greed, hatred, and delusion. And so the practices in stillness, in the isolation or in the quietude of one's own room, and the practices in the world, and encounters with the world, and with the world, with that is meant everything. Everything we encounter out there, as soon as we leave the isolation of our own little private sphere, that has to go together. It has to be integrated. And both sides influence each other. If we are confused and always reactive and just run around like a chicken without its head through life in a chaotic way, then of course when we come to a more quiet practice, a quiet time, then we reap the repercussions of that. The causes of that will be experienced, and it will take a long time for the mind to settle. And usually then you're just occupied for a good chunk of the time to allowing the dust which we have thrown up in our daily life to settle. But if one has the aspiration to go a little bit deeper than that, rather than just taking using one's meditation in daily life to take in a break from the hectic and busyness of daily life and so forth, then of course our daily life has to come in sync with our formal practice. And also, of course, vice versa. If we have the right attitude in our practice, and we're not always arguing internally with ourselves, we're not always expecting something else to happen than that we have. Basically, we're just continuing these worldly habits in the stillness of our room, maybe just a little bit quieter, but still the same thing. We're constantly at odds either with ourselves or with the voices in ourselves. Very often there's a whole committee talking to each other in ourselves. If that's the case, then of course the resultant consequences are that we will live our lives like that. This is the conditions which then will express itself in the way we move about in the world. So these things belong together. They are not separated from each other. So I think I want to just leave it with that tonight as a encouragement to let these teachings which you've heard, which I read out, let these resonate a little bit in you and connect with you. Also, that, of course, that aspect, what this, you know, even the suggestion of awakening, of nibbana, of these kind of lofty ideals which we have in Buddhism, what they do with you. Do you see this for you as a realistic option, one could say, you know, to go for, to orient towards in your life? Or is it more a little bit like the examples mentioned, one still more limits oneself to, yes, one wants to be born, but one doesn't want to die? That's of course the worldly mind, which is still influenced very much by the pleasure-pain, the dichotomy, which is kind of oscillating between these two points. We want pleasure, pleasant experiences, happiness, and we don't want the other. It's basically what it's meant by wanting to be born and not want to die. We want to be born, of course, in the hope that eventually there will be, this is not what people say, but eventually there will be a birth which is just bringing us happiness forever and ever, isn't it? Otherwise, why would you want to be reborn? If the expectation would be to have just suffering, dukkha, 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 who wants to be reborn? But still, You know, the worldly mind is like that, doesn't seem to see that there is a way out of this cycle, this oscillation between seeking pleasure and trying at all costs to avoid pain, to deny pain, to suppress pain, and so forth. But suppression, denial of the unpleasant and wanting and hanging on to, you know, ideas and longings for pleasant experiences, that's not it, isn't it? And then we are very much entrenched in the birth and death game. We are not even one inch beyond it or out of it, because we haven't seen the fundamental delusion we're under, you know, that we are operating within a very tight and constrained operating system, you could say. The operating system is putting very tight conditions on our lives. I want this, I want pleasure, I don't want pain. That's very often what the most simple way of putting it. But as a practitioner, one opens up to the limitations which are embedded in that kind of way of operating. Because this is very limiting our spiritual potential. One couldn't even call it spiritual, isn't it, if one operates like that. It's very worldly and keeps us bound, it keeps us tied into the constraints of greed, hatred and delusion. So then the aspiration, of course, the aspiration for truth, for realization, is something we need to acknowledge. Is this there? Do we see it as a realistic way for us? And then how do I apply this in my life, in my circumstances? Very specific circumstances I'm in. And this is, you know, for all of us, well, even for us monastics, that probably is different, you know, if we're asking ourselves this question. And this question has to be really honest and open, and even if the answer is, I don't want to be enlightened. Actually, someone was saying that on the last retreat, longer retreat here in Dhammapada, I don't want to be enlightened. But he was actually very diligently practicing and really investigating and putting himself to the test, actually in a very good way. So I thought maybe this is just a kind of trick he's playing with himself. Or maybe because he's realized that the becoming mind, wanting to become enlightened, that the becoming mind, this is not it. And that's a very fine line. If you want to become enlightened, yeah, I would encourage that everybody could say, don't become enlightened, rather than be enlightened or be awakened. Be awakened to the moment, to the truth of the moment. That's a much more realistic instruction for all of us. In fact, this book here, out of which I did the reading, is called Being Dhamma. And Lompo Chave often also had little sequences like that, where it was speaking about maybe in the initial phases of practice, it's all about becoming more peaceful, becoming more concentrated, becoming more gentle, more mindful, more compassionate, more this, more that. But eventually we have to see that as long as we're in the realm of becoming, it's the realm of birth and death. It will just go on and on and on. Even in the refined stages of practice, we're still in the realm of becoming, of birth and death. And that's why then he would encourage his disciples of being Dhamma, or being Dharma, which is pointing to the immediacy of realization. There where the truth lies. The truth cannot lie in the next moment or postponed to the next episode of our practice, episode of our life, when conditions are better and fitting. We have the ideal setup for our practice. That is it's a great monastic disease in Thailand, has been at least, I've observed that monks go around seeking for the ideal place for practice, the ideal monastery, the perfect teacher. One monk friend of mine, he was instructing the novices at one point at Wat Nanachan in our Thai monastery, and he was actually doing quite a good job. And one young novice, I think he was either Anagarika or Samaneri, came to him and said, "Thank you, Ajahn, you're a very nice person, you're doing a good job, but I really need to be with an Arahant, so I have to go and leave this monastery and go and seek to practice with an Arahant." So that was, he said it's right into his face, actually, which was in a friendly way. Of course, he was saying, you're a nice guy, but you know what I need is an arahant. So you can't really give me what I really need. I don't know where this person ended up, of course, but it was a nice anecdote. It's a nice anecdote to tell now that, well, be careful with such thoughts. If you have another situation, another place, another environment, another teacher, another circumstances will provide the ideal conditions for one's realization, for one's practice. Could be that you need a different situation, a different teacher, a different environment, could well be. But also, it could be a trap. If you detect that one has a tendency to always seek very quickly something else, some other practice even. Some people also find it difficult to commit themselves to a particular practice approach. They seem to oscillate a lot, don't seem to have the right long enough stamina to stay with one particular approach and try it out for a little while and see what is it. Is this bearing fruit or not? Just squarely asking oneself. But if you have a different practice every other week or so, it's difficult to assess if this is working or not. So you have to give it a little bit more. And then, yes, it's not just Dharma practice, it's not just about one meditation methods or two, you know, one techniques and then hammering away at your mind with it. That's not it. Especially not doing it mechanically. But always, whatever tool we pick up, in this example, the saw, we want to make sure we have the right saw. If we're sawing wood, we don't want to come with a little, what they call, jigsaw. So if you have a big piece of wood, you don't want to come with a jigsaw. You want to have the right saw, the right instrument. And you want to have some sharp teeth on your saw, don't you? And of course you want to apply the saw in the right way. It's not so easy actually to saw a wood in the most effective way. You can use a lot of effort and not get very far in sawing a log of wood. Similarly, we have to also be aware how we use the instruments of our practice, the methods, even how we use our attention, how we give attention to the mind, actually. That's very important. It's also a tool, isn't it? To give attention to what we experience. The attention we give to our experience is like a tool. And there's a quality to the attention we give to ourselves. Sometimes the attention can be very uptight even, or very constricted, contracted, you know, like tunnel vision attention. Sometimes it can be very slack and, you know, it's you just have a too open and slack approach and, I'll just be here in the moment and follow my heart. That doesn't seem to go very far. So what is the right quality of attention to give to present moment experience? And nobody can tell you that in great detail, even if you give your list, and we have that in Buddhism, we have a list of aspects, how attention, you know, should be. But how can you know that it's the right amount of mindfulness, the right amount of attention, the right quality of attention which you give to experience? My experience is you can only find out through trial and error, isn't it? You can only take the risk of going extreme, that's all right. Failing is absolutely legitimate. I invite you all to fail happily. If you cannot fail, I think if you cannot fail, you cannot practice, isn't it? We all hopefully learn through failure, to getting it wrong, going into a cul-de-sac and realized, it's not going any further there. But, you know, trying again, not getting discouraged by failures, hopefully learning through it. The learning aspect is a very important aspect of the cultivation of the human heart, of the human mind. One of my monk friends in Thailand, a teacher there, he calls Buddhism very often, he calls it an education system. When people ask him, is Buddhism a philosophy, a religion, or what is it? His answer is, Buddhism is a system of education. And then, of course, he goes into a few more details what this education system is all about, but it's quite true, isn't it? We're educating ourselves, we're educating our hearts, our minds, and our orientation is towards liberation, towards awakening. We're educating ourselves to be present, fully present, for our moment-to-moment experience in order to realize the truth, to be Dhamma in the end, to be the truth rather than to become the truth at some point in the future. So I think I'll leave you with that tonight and offer this for your further contemplation. Thank you for listening.